before I introduce Tim Doyle, I want to make a quick announcement. David jumped up here before I was able to get in, so I just wanted to say that on the 2nd, next week, next Tuesday, Paul Bogart, who used to be a professor at Northland, is going to be returning and giving a talk that I'm very excited about called Letters from a Disappearing World, Reconciling Love and Fear in the Age of Climate Change. And that will be at 7 p.m. in the Sigurd Olson Institute here. I think it's connected to some of our themes for today. So Erica Hanicle was going to introduce Tim, but she couldn't be here, so I was. That's wonderful. And I'll read her statement first. She said, Dr. Tim Doyle is an associate professor of philosophy at Northland College. He is also a sometime pirate, landscape architect of stones, and belongs in the world's championship of bocce. I am honored to call him my friend. And all those things are very true. And I, too, am honored to call him my friend. He's a very special and important person to me. And I know that he is to some of you here as well. And I would add to that list of accomplishments that Erica put that you could add hundreds more on there. Of all the people I know, I think Tim is probably the person who has packed the most lifetimes into his life so far, has done the most different kinds of things, has learned the most different kinds of things. He's like a Wikipedia sort of walking around, and I mean that in the best way. And he is also the most fun person to sit around a bonfire in the snow with, or really to sit around anything in any weather with. So he's just a magical person, and I'm very, very excited to get to hear him speak to us today. So his talk is called A Meditation on Hope and Despair, and without further ado, please help me welcome Tim.
Thank you, Cynthia, and good morning, everyone. Meditation on Hope and Despair. Some of you are probably hoping it will be short so you can get to the snacks. Others who know me are already despairing. Last October, the MinnPost Earth Journal ran an article on Jem Bendel's notion of deep adaptation, in which Bendel had claimed, as a result of global climate change, we're facing imminent social collapse. Governments, economies, social institutions, agriculture, industries, and so on a range that he saw as from inevitable collapse to possible extinction. Real cheery stuff, right? Bendel self-published his paper last July, and since then it's become a viral phenomenon. Here at Northland and in the surrounding community, the reaction to it was so strong that we put together a public discussion on the topic, and that November 9th, Sigurd Olson Century Room was filled with more people than I've ever seen before or since at an event. Clearly, Bendel's doom and gloom message had struck a chord, which is slightly ironic since his article was rejected for publication for not striking a hopeful enough tone. I took part as a panelist at that gathering, and partly as a result of my remarks that evening, was invited to speak with you today. But despite a few more remarks in that direction, this is not a talk about climate change. Facing the challenges associated with climate change, regardless of whether Bendel's prediction of imminent collapse is correct or not, or even partially correct, it's how we face the challenges that is of the utmost importance. Why? Because if people feel a combination of urgency and inability to make a real difference, then they can easily become overwhelmed with a sense of hopelessness and despair. And to be sure, there is a lot of talk of hope and despair all around us today. How, one might wonder, are we to maintain hope when faced not only with the enormity of such a problem, but also with industry hacks and politicians who cultivate a culture of denial? Are we to simply throw up our hands, give up in despair? Global climate change is certainly one of the most pressing issues of our day. But what I want to reflect on today is far more personal for many of us, the relationship between hope and despair. I look at this issue not so much as a scholar, but from a personal point of view, I've told friends that if I ever became cynical, I would have to quit teaching. How could I honestly face a class if I felt we were in a situation in which it made absolutely no sense to keep on learning, working, fighting? Fortunately, I haven't reached that point. On the other hand, I'm no Pollyanna. So where does that leave me? Where does that leave us? We could start by asking, what is hope? One time, the author and gadfly Derek Jensen asked that question of an audience. And by way of reply, they worked out a rather interesting definition of hope. They defined it as a longing for some future over which you have no control, no agency. It means, they agreed, that you are essentially powerless. To say that you hope things will change means that you hope someone or something else will change it for you. I'm not saying that I agree with their definition, but it is an interesting attempt, and it does provide food for thought. It also serves to put on notice the overly sentimental version of hope that inspired Jensen and his audience to dig deeper in the first place. That sentimental notion of hope is the binary counterpart to despair. In both cases, we feel overwhelmed and powerless. Indeed, most people see hopelessness not as a description of a contented state of mind, but rather as synonymous with despair. The pair of terms is often portrayed as if it includes the whole spectrum of possible responses. But in fact, they leave an awful lot of territory uncovered. So let's explore the space that is held in tension between the two and see whether there's at least a third option, something between hope and despair, or perhaps something beyond hope and despair. Earlier I said it was how we face the challenges that is of utmost importance. In an email exchange with my friend David Satry, he pointed out, this was maybe 2 days ago, he pointed out that Paul Tillich, searching for a word beyond hope and as an alternative to faith, chose courage as the virtue by which one lives beyond both hope and despair into the fullness of one's life. I like that phrase, living into the fullness of one's life. And I want to come back to it in a minute. To me, this is a solidly pragmatic outlook. The Dalai Lama has said that if the situation is such that it can be remedied, then there's no need to worry about it. In other words, if there is a solution or a way out of the difficulty, you do not need to be overwhelmed by it. The appropriate action is to seek its solution. Then it is clearly more sensible to spend your time focusing on the solution rather than worrying about the problem. Alternatively, if there is no solution, no possibility of resolution, then there's also no point in being worried about it because you can't do anything about it anyway. In that case, the sooner you accept this fact, the better, the easier it will be for you. This formula, of course, implies directly confronting the problem and taking a realistic view. Our tendency to make things worse than they already are is why Buddhists call despair an afflictive emotion. What this means, first, is that it is an emotion, and so we will naturally experience it from time to time. But it becomes an afflictive emotion when our imagination latches on and won't let go. Then it can quite easily build and build into something truly debilitating. So the attitude with which one faces a daunting challenge is all important. A courageous attitude, an attitude of contentment, of peace of mind, these are good. But I want to stress the point that you do not have to have hope in order to do the work that needs to be done. Vaclav Havel put it well when he wrote that, "I often think about situations that are particularly hopeless, such as prison. I understand it above all as a state of mind, not a state of the world. It's a dimension of the soul. It's an ability to work for something because it is good, not just because it has a chance to succeed." Let me illustrate this with a personal example. I currently have stage 4 metastatic cancer that is doubling at quite a fast rate. With the help of friends, I've been looking into getting into one of the various clinical trials at institutions all over the country. But so far to no avail. The criteria for acceptance into each trial is quite detailed. There's really no hope for a cure, and the usual drug that could buy some extra time caused me such brain fog the first time around that I've opted not to go on it again. Some might argue that philosophers suffer from brain fog anyway. So what do? I continue to work, to teach, to research, and to write, and to do all those nice things Cynthia said about me. Because that's what I love to do. At the same time, I also worked hard to get back into the good graces of the woman that I love. Facing loss of love and loss of life, it would have been easy, I think, to have given in to despair. And at one point early on, I very nearly did. But then I realized that even without hope, I was not ready to give up. Why not? Because there is a rich, fertile ground between the typical emotions of hope and despair. How one lives in that space is what Tillich or David meant by that phrase, living into the fullness of one's life. I've heard it said that life wants life. This is beyond reason, beyond emotion, beyond hope or despair. It's an inability to stop responding to life. I'm going to shift gears just a bit here and talk about aesthetics. It might seem odd to speak of aesthetics when speaking of hope and despair, but there is an aesthetic component involved here, one that is manifested in our attitude and behavior. In the field of aesthetics, we speak of aspection, which is learning to open up to and respond to certain aspects of a work of art or an environment. There's an aesthetic aspect to what we respond to and how we respond in every situation. In Japanese aesthetics, there's a concept called aware, which is an awareness and acceptance of the ephemeral nature of everything. The cherry blossoms are experienced as even more beautiful when one is at the same time aware that they will last but a day. Loving relationships and poetry are all the more precious because they must eventually come to an end, as we all must. To borrow from David once again, it seems to me the aesthetic describes that fertile middle ground between hope and despair. Since everything succumbs to change, aware allows one to live within that with great contentment and, well, courage. This sounds easy, but of course it's not. Sometimes we may feel on the verge of being overwhelmed by the difficulties that confront us. Sometimes we may simply be so exhausted that we risk burnout. And then we have to develop ways to lift our spirits. In Buddhism, it is recommended to reflect on one's good fortune, starting with being grateful for even having our most basic needs met, or for having some talent, or for being loved by someone, for finding beauty in the ordinary, or for having performed some good deed in the past. This is a form of mind training, one of many that you can develop, which can be of help in difficult times. If we do not gain control over our restless mind, it becomes too easy in difficult times to sink further into a feeling of helplessness and becomes an afflictive emotion. In this way, we create within ourselves the very conditions of despair. To live with courage and contentment or peace of mind, rather than darting back and forth between naive and hope and despair like some squirrel crossing a road, this is just living into the fullness of one's life. It's an attitude that demands much more of us than does the simple dichotomy of hope and despair. So the message is to move beyond that simple dualism to explore that fertile middle ground. Thank you.